6th of July, 1995, with Reverend Chris Hartmeyer. We're discussing earlier your sequence of involvement and, you know, the path that where you with the migrant ministry, you know, connect with the United Farm Workers. And one of the things we'd like to, you know, that's one of our areas of interest, that, you know, the coming together, and you're talking about the parallelisms in some ways. What about direct involvement with United Farm Workers? I know that at times the migrant ministry even went so far as paying for some of the people, or paying the salaries and supporting the salaries of people who were involved in United Farm Workers. That's one of, I was thinking more of your personal activities, involvement in what was going on, the development of the United Farm Workers, you know, the moving, you know, the acquiring of the 40 acres and the development there, and then subsequent the movement to La Paz and the developments there. Can we talk about that?
Yeah, there were times when, I mean, I was like another staff person of the UFW. Mm-hmm. I mean, in 1969, when Caesar went on the boycott tour, I mean, I was his advance man for from September to November, not for the whole tour, but for about a half to two-thirds of the tour. Mm-hmm. I was the advance person for Caesar's trip. And in a major political campaign, Prop 22, Prop 14, voter registration in East LA when Bobby Kennedy was running.
Yeah, the Viva Kennedy drive.
Mm-hmm. For times like that, I just sort of like full-time did what was being done, whatever that was. probably the Art Torres campaign. There were a number of different, you know, political campaigns.
Art had worked with the union, had he not?
Yes, he had. There were a number of different political campaigns where I just sort of like dropped everything and went to work for whatever period of time it was, 6, 7, 8 weeks at a time. Some of them in L.A., some of them other places. When there was like a crisis in the fields, I would go there. But usually, I was there to help other people who were there, other church people who were there, or to learn what the situation was so I could recruit other church people to be there, or to be on the scene directly so that from that location I could recruit other church people to be there. I mean, it was just, you know, I'm thinking of Coachella in 73, you know, when the Teamsters, you know, came in, and I mean, it worked a lot better to say, I'm in Coachella, this is what's happening, we need you here, now. Benton Rhodes from the National Council of Churches was telling me this last Saturday, you know, at this meeting down in Orange County, that I called him on a Friday in his office and asked him to be in Coachella on Monday. He was in New York. So, I mean, it's talking about brazen, but anyway, because I was there and I felt the intensity of what was going on there, you know, I was able to do that, and also I was able to make people feel that they were needed, you know, right away. And but really, until 1981, most of what I did was for the sake of organizing church support for the United Farm Workers. And my direct involvement was kind of like for the sake of that. There were exceptions to that, but I think year in and year out, my presence with the union was for the sake of being able to organize other people to be there because they were going to be needed to be there.
Yet there were a few times, as I read the book, there were a few major events, very few, that you weren't there.
Present, yeah. Well, Caesar was very good about, I mean, talked earlier about the relationship, right? The relationship worked because we were clear that the union was leading and we were supporting, and we never pretended anything else.
Yeah.
And but it also worked because he could count on us and kind of knew that we would do whatever we, you know, whatever we could. But he was very respectful about the fact that there was the UFW and then there was the farm worker ministry. They were separate organizations. He couldn't tell us what to do. He would call and ask. He says, this is what's happening. This is what we need. And as time went on, you know, he knew that's all he had to do, that we would do whatever we could, whatever was possible. And usually it was possible.
Yeah.
He used...
I know Sidney, either Sidney Smith or Pat Hoffman, one of them in the book says that basically the migrant ministry, I'm paraphrasing, you know, was in a position where even if it wanted to, it couldn't say no to the UFW because of the, you know, this commitment going way back on this idea of the community organizational process that, and, you know, commitment to that.
I think you might have been thinking about something I probably said in one of those books.
I think it's a quote something attributed to
you. When Delano hit in 1965, I mean, none of us knew what was going to happen. But I at least knew that this was going to be a big administrative nightmare, right? That we were going to lose money, that churches were going to be upset. I mean, the degree to which it happened, fortunately, I had no idea. But I knew there was going to be a problem, and I knew that we'd have to deal with that problem. But even if I had said, I'm sorry, Jim, I'm sorry, Dave, I'm sorry, Gil, you know, it was just, this is too controversial. I mean, the churches will never buy this. We can't let you be on the picket line. I mean, you can be sort of like in the back room telling us what's happening, but you can't be visible. You know, if I had come up with some kind of a, you know, bureaucratic response like that, I mean, they would have done it anyway, I'm sure. I mean, it never occurred to me to do that, but at least I had some administrative nervousness about it. The rest of the folks were just like, I mean, right there. So, in fact, Caesar, when he would introduce someone, say he'd introduce me to a crowd at a meeting or a rally or something like that, he'd always say, you know, the migrant ministry, it was kind of nice, but at times it made me a little nervous, right? Whatever I've never asked for anything that they didn't do. And, you know, which is, you know, farm worker crowd is great, but I'm always thinking, what are the church folks thinking about this? The guy never says no to them about nothing.
not what you heard, not what you wanted those regional, you know, synod type organizations to hear, right?
But that was like, that was one of our passing thoughts. There usually wasn't anybody in the crowd who had cared, and most people thought it was a compliment, and of course we did think it was a compliment. I was thinking after we finished, it's interesting, but maybe to educators it might be interesting too. The church had set up this structure. Where there was a Northern California Council of Churches, a Southern California Council of Churches. They worked together in something called the California Church Council, and then the California Church Council sponsored the Migrant Ministry and the Office for State Affairs, which was a legislative body, right? So we were like 1, 2, 3, 4 steps removed from the actual denominational power structure. So which accounts for a lot of our freedom. I mean, we were just out there doing our thing.
And they weren't sure what you were doing.
Some of them were, but many of them weren't. But still, it was all very carefully, structurally organized. So we were truly their child. And so when it all hit the fan, right, then they couldn't just say, oh, well, we don't know who these people are. They're just like, they had to account for us.
They can't. Which just own their offspring, right?
I used to like it to sort of like, when I grew up, you know, with the washing machines had these ringers in them. I used to, you know, like the church put this little arm of itself into the ring, into the washing machine wringer, mm-hmm. and it got drawn more and more. And even though the whole body didn't go in, the whole body felt what was happening.
Felt the pain.
And that's what happened to the church with the migrant ministry. But it was really like, I'm thinking, Caesar fasted in Arizona. You know, I went over there. The march to Sacramento, I went on the yeah. march. Caesar's fast in Delano, I was be there as often as I could. The trip, you know, the boycott tour of 1969, which was really led up to the victory of 1970. You know, I was there as an advanced person. Prop 22, Prop 14, I would, you know, 2 or 3 months, I just did nothing else but that. And there were probably other occasions like that, but they were exceptions to the rule. And the rule was that I was the director of the migrant ministry and the National Farm Worker Ministry, and that's the work I did.
What do you mean, well, for instance, let's say Prop 14, when you say you did nothing else but that, what did you do?
I was Marshall Gantz was in charge of the campaign, and I was his administrator. I did everything that had to be done in the office to back up the staff for that campaign, a very large staff. So I was there from, I was there from 8 a.m. to 11 p.m., 7 days a week for 2 months.
It would be nice for the historical record person, and the next person comes on and reads this. What did they do at 14 Mill? Who did they talk to? What kind of operation did they run? If you could flesh that out a little bit.
Well, Prop 14, of course, we started with bumper stickers. And just like, you know, having lots of people in parking lots talking about Proposition 14 and giving out bumper stickers. Mm-hmm. And everybody was just having a wonderful time, and it was very successful. And all of a sudden, the growers' ads hit. I don't know what you know about the history of Prop 14. But the growers put out these ads, small farmers talking about how their, you know, their private property was going to be infringed on by, and in a week's time, people in the parking lots filled it. It was like a changed. Mm-hmm. Prop 14, people say, oh, is that the one about private property? Or is that the one, you know, like, all of a sudden we had to explain more. Mm-hmm. And then more, of course, then it got worse and worse and worse, and those ads just had a terrible. But we did bumper stickering, we did house meetings with people, we did fundraisers, we did leafleting everywhere. We had a speaking, we spoke to as many organizations, as group as we could. We went to newspaper editorial boards to try to get their support in the proposition. We made TV spots of our own, although that was pretty well frustrated because Caesar had made a private deal with Jerry Brown that Jerry Brown was going to be the TV campaign. I mean, I think a terrible mistake, but still, that was the deal. And Marshall and I made some other ads using. Who's the guy who does the ads for Roundup? You know, that garden spray. One of the, you know, real solid actors in, you know, in Hollywood. And he did an ad sort of like exposing the fact that agribusiness was really behind this. That the small farmers were out front, but really agribusiness was paying this, you know, was paying for this whole campaign. But it ran one or two times. As soon as Jerry Brown's people saw it, it was killed, and it was Jerry Brown all the way on TV. And we just got murdered by TV spots, and we just learned a brutal lesson about what TV spots can do. Because Prop 22, we fought on the streets. Yeah. And I mean,
the billboard.
We killed them.
You know, that technique, I don't ever remember. I mean, sure, there's always been scientific,
that was
the billboarding technique.
Okay, it developed in the boycott in New England. Mm-hmm. I think Marcos Munoz was the first one to use billboards on street corners, you know, for like boycotting grapes. But, and Leroy could tell you, I don't know where he got the idea. But Leroy got the idea, talked to me about it, we planned it, and I ran the billboarding campaign of Prop 22. That's one of I'm as proud of that as almost anything I've ever done. Because it was just such a fantastic.
People still go back to the corners that you selected or your campaign selected because of the whole idea of hitting the places where there's high traffic and, you know, just in there.
Well, I don't know if you remember, we set up a park. I mean, we used one of the parks in downtown LA and brought farm workers there who lived in tents. And then every morning we would get together, you know, at 5 o'clock and plan the day And it was organized in teams of like 7, 8, 9, 10. And we plotted the streets as to which street corners and which freeway interchanges were the most, were the busiest. And then we had these beautiful black and white billboards that said, you know, Catholic bishops say no on 22. The LA Times says no on 22. Council of Churches says no on 22. You know, Paul Newman says no on 22. What, I don't remember if Paul Newman did or not. But anyway, that was the... But that was small. The no on 22 was gigantic. And Proposition 22 is a fraud. And that was a big part of the campaign because the signature gathering had been fraudulent enough. That was Jerry Brown's involvement. He was Secretary of State, and he investigated the fraud in the gathering of the signatures for Prop 22, and that allowed us to sort of like publicize it as a fraud. And it's always easier to get a no vote anyway. Mm-hmm. And people, we created some crashes, which, you know, we had people at overpasses on freeways. And it was such an exciting phenomenon for the public that they would go outside the windows of their cars and wave at the things, and then the next thing you hear is crash. So we stopped that quickly. But people would call me from work, and Leroy too, and just tell me that they cried on the way to work. Because the image we created was the big growers trying to pass a law that would make it impossible for farm workers and organizers, and farm workers out on the streets doing the only thing they could afford to do, which was holding billboards. And people would go by those billboards and they would just start to cry, and they'd cry all the way to work, and then everybody in their offices would be talking about it. Did you see those folks? Yeah, I saw them over there, and I saw them over there. It was a trip. It was just 2 weeks of and then in our meetings, we have a get-together meeting before we go out for the afternoon rush hour, right? And then people would tell stories about what happened. You know, how people would stop and give them money and wish them well and give them a cross or, you know. It was phenomenal. It was amazing. But that was his brainstorm.
That was Leroy's.
Mm-hmm. And Leroy came up with the black and white symbol and the size of the billboards. And we had them on, you know, sticks that, you know, it was like two sticks.
Hinged
so that we could get them in and out of cars. Mm-hmm. And then we created a system for how it had to be done. So many feet apart, so many billboards, wave to people, you know, smile, get their attention. If you want to sit down or you want to act like a laggard, then go somewhere else, not here. It was really amazing. And then every day we perfected it a little more because it was the first time. And the farm workers would have suggestions. Well, this seemed to work pretty well, and that worked better, and blah, blah, blah. But anyway, that was like the culmin. We already had Proposition 22 beat. That was like the crowning blow. And of course, that happened up north too. I was just happened to be in L.A. But now there's an example. Leroy came to L.A. He made office space in our migrant ministry office. Okay, and when Jim Drake moved the office of the boycott office across the street from where we were, we closed down our office and moved across to the sort of like storefront where he was. So that our office would be next door to the union boycott office. Because I had learned from years of experience that being across the street was too far away. Things just happened too fast. You would not be able to keep up. So anyway.
Then, what year was it that you left the ministry? Farm worker ministry? And
yeah, we ought to talk about the transition from the migrant ministry to the farm worker ministry. You asked about
right,
it.
Right, yeah.
I left in May of 81 to go up to La Paz.
We'll come back.
But basically what happened was the movement became national.
Mm-hmm.
So like churches all over the country were involved. Denominations were involved. Mm-hmm. Migrant ministries in other states were involved.
Yeah.
So there was like this conversation about we don't have a lot of resources.
Yeah.
We're all kind of on the same wavelength, supporting farm workers in their efforts to get, you know, self-determination and justice was what we ought to be doing. Mm-hmm. So really the California Migrant Ministry kind of led the way.
Okay.
And get other migrant ministries and other church organizations to form this national farm worker ministry. Caesar wanted to call it the National Migrant Ministry. He never stopped calling it the Migrant Ministry. Just because of nostalgia, fondness for the name. Mm-hmm. The Migrant Ministry was the first organizational ally, right? So he never called it the Farm Worker Ministry. He always called it the Migrant Ministry. But the other folks felt like the Farm Worker Ministry was better. And we kind of, California kind of gave in because we were getting our way in so much, you know, in terms of the purpose of the organization. Mm-hmm. Then there was a big battle about having a Latino director. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it was 1971. Mm-hmm. I mean, this white boy from California, he shouldn't be the director of this organization. We should have a Chicano. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of fuss. But Caesar went to one of the meetings, one of the formation meetings, and he got the Latinos together, and he just told them. Yeah. And he said, Chris is who we want. Yeah. I know Chris can do it. Chris should be the one that does it. And that's what I want. So the Godfather basically got the troops in line, and then I was elected to be the, you know, the first director of the Farm Worker Ministry. But that included Catholic, for the first time, we had Catholic religious orders. We had National Federation of Priest Councils, the National Assembly of Women Religious. Mm-hmm. We had Catholic groups. We had Church Women United. And then we had denominational groups. So we had member organizations. Some of them were denominations. Some of them were Catholic religious orders. Some of them were like coalitions of Catholic groups. And that was the beginning of the Farm Worker Ministry. And it just made life, you know, more complicated, actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but better. Better. It was we had sort of like more credibility to reach for this national support for what the union needed, mostly in California, not exclusively, but mostly in California.
Yeah, but the focus of your efforts are essentially California, are they not? But they continue to that 71 to 81 period to be...
Well, but also Florida.
Florida and Texas.
Florida and Texas.
And then Ohio and mm-hmm. with the flock.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, just
and now the Farm Worker Ministry is very involved in with Flock in Ohio, and they're going into North Carolina, mm-hmm. with PICUN, which is an organization in Oregon, and with, of course, the UFW.
Yeah, yeah. Both Washington and Oregon have movements right now. Yeah.
But our closeness, that remember when I was saying like uh-huh. it was a little embarrassing. We do everything he asks us to do.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It. A lot of people thought it, and some people said it, that we were too close. You know, that we weren't really independent, that we weren't really
that Chavez was really running the ministry.
Right. It was like that we were a department of the United Farm Workers, right? And, you know, the truth is somewhere in between. I mean, we weren't quite a department of the United Farm Workers, but we weren't really quite an independent church organization either, so there was like a definite...
Yeah.
There was a definite ambiguity and a definite danger, you know, that we would lose our soul. And in the Philippines thing, we did lose a chunk of our soul, no doubt about it.
This is the trip.
Caesar's trip to the Philippines.
Yeah.
Marcos giving him an award. And then, of course, a firestorm of criticism from the religious community, especially the Catholics, because, you know, the missionaries in the Philippines. We're just like, whew, they couldn't believe it. They could not believe it. And they wanted us to say something, to do something, to get Caesar to reconsider, to think it over, to make a public statement, right? He was not, they were his hosts. He went there. He did it because of the Filipino farm workers. He was not going to spit on his hosts or on the Filipino farm workers. He was not going to say a word to make these unhappy people happy. Mm-hmm. Boom.
Do you understand what he meant when he said he did it for the Filipino farm workers?
He had promised them he would go to the Philippines early on in the struggle, and he did it just because of their national pride, to help the union become closer to the Filipino farm workers, because that had always been a problem. There was always an ethnic tension between the Mexicanos and the Filipinos.
But most of the Filipino farm workers were very opposed to Marcos, weren't they? I mean, didn't the trip get kind of confused or something?
I don't think the Filipino farm workers cared that much.
I mean, you know, Philip Veracruz was very offended by the trip.
I know, but Philip was a lefty. I mean, Philip's not your average farm workers. Philip's to the left of practically anybody who's ever been in the union.
Uh-huh.
So, He's not representative.
So he's not, his voice doesn't represent.
But there were some who, you know, but I don't think the, in general, I don't think the masses of the Philippine farm workers cared that much about Marcos.
So he, they, your guess would be they think he actually did fulfill a promise to them, right?
I think the Filipino farm workers in general were glad that Caesar went and were not that involved in the big controversy after he came back. But Filipino activists, you know, and religious leaders who were who knew the Philippine situation were just like livid.
I mean, I don't. I know Philip.
No, I think Pete would have. I think Pete
left
would have
the board by then. I think.
But
I
mean, no.
See, I don't remember anything.
No,
about
Pete would have. Pete
never said well.
Pete would have. Pete more represented what the average Filipino farm worker.
In Philip's book, Philip says Pete never said anything. But he just said okay. That was all he ever had to say.
But Philip, but Pete still had opinions, and I think Pete's opinion was that he was glad that Caesar went to the Philippines. But it put us in the middle between Caesar and a lot of our church friends who wanted us to do something, and we basically didn't. And I don't think we handled it well. I mean, I think that was an example of where our closeness kind of paralyzed us. I mean, it didn't cause us to do evil, but it paralyzed us. How could we make a public statement, you know, about anything that Caesar did, right? But and we shouldn't have and wouldn't have. But we could have had a face-to-face sit-down meeting with him and said, look, you know, this is what we hear, this is what we're learning. For many of us who weren't involved in the Philippines in any way, we learned from Caesar's trip what was going on. So anyway, and Caesar's arguments were very persuasive, and so we began to feel, well, maybe Marcos isn't so bad.
It's a medalist fault, right?
Who knew?
Well, you know, any...
I mean, it had... Because the quality of the people who were angry, you kind of knew. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You kind of knew that... Yeah. There was something going on there that we didn't know about.
Yeah.
I mean, these weren't just crazy folks, you know, making noises. These were people who were deeply hurt by his being there. But all in all, I'd do it the same way again. I'd be as close as we were.
This transition from the state to national. And then as far as your transition, then it takes another step, right?
Right.
I mean, any transition that has multiple layers and so on, but can you talk to us about that, about, you know, where you ultimately, you leave the National Farm Worker Ministry and join the staff of the United Farm Workers, right?
I was probably ready to do that about, you know, 78, 79. I was kind of like running out of gas. And that was a couple things. It was that I had been organizing church people for a long time, and some of it was joyous and some of it was frustrating, right? So, and then every, you know, just re-educating and re-educating people on the same issues, you know, and so, but the other thing was the union didn't need the farm worker ministry the way it did before. After the law passed, after the Agricultural Labor Relations Act passed, and then after the first couple stormy years of trying to get the law enforced, right, there was, it was pretty obvious that, you know, like the boycott was less important. So like, what were people going to do in the pews? What were the churches going to do if the boycott wasn't that important? So anyway, for that reason, for those two reasons, I was beginning to kind of like lose my energy. But I made a deal with my wife to stay in Culver City till Gordy got to college. So that's what we did. And really, before Gordy got to college, I left in May. Gordy graduated from high school in June. She came to join me at the end of the summer, in the fall of 81.
And that's when we moved. And you were there from what? From 81 until
May of 81 until January of 89.
Okay. What did you do there? What I mean, I'm sure there's multiple roles and multiple
tasks. At first, I was like an assistant to the president. I mean, I worked in Caesar's office.
Okay.
And sort of like tried to help organize his work. And he had some, you know, management ideas that I tried to help him implement in terms of communicating with the departments and restructuring the union and all, you know, that sort of stuff. But that, I think, February of 82 was when, I mean, Florence died shortly after we, Sister Florence died shortly after she was killed in a car accident, shortly after we got there. And then the financial management department kind of like was without leadership. And then he needed somebody he could trust in there. So he asked me to do that. And because I maybe was the one who could best do that. I didn't know. In some ways, I didn't know from diddly, right? But maybe I knew more than anybody else, because I had least managed budgets before.
Yeah.
And Florence had set up a very good system that was running well. And, of course, the accountants were there. Could not imagine why. The data processing guy and the accountant were both recruited by Florence and had absolute faith in her. You know, her wisdom and her guidance and her expertise, and you know, here was this guy, here was this minister, just, I mean, give me a break. He doesn't know about computers, he doesn't know about accounting, I mean, what is he doing here? So, there was some bad days over there, until they got a little more used to me. And I guess that's what I did, which was a lot of learning, right?
Yeah.
Until, basically, the union decided they needed a new computer. So, Caesar asked me to like head up the computer search. It was like a special project.
Uh-huh.
And I said, Caesar, how are we going to get this, how's the financial management department going to run? It'll run, he says. He says, just think about it. The energy we put into the right computer for the union will advance us way more than getting this day-to-day work done will do. Even if the day-to-day work falters some, this other is so important. So then we set about looking for a new computer. And what we wanted was a computer that we could handle. There was some debate at the time that maybe PCs would be better than a mainframe, right? But it was a little early in the PC era. And so we went for a Sperry at that time, now Unisys, right? We went for a Sperry mainframe and for a software called Mapper, which we could learn to program. I could write programs in Mapper. And other volunteers, you know, farm workers, former farm workers could write programs and, you know, debug and change and improve software, you know, using this, but it was inefficient, you know, it lost a lot of machine time and it had its defects, but we had a, you know, a big computer department without having any analysts, you know, without any computer analysts or programmers or, I mean, just us folks. It was crazy. Sperry thought we were nuts, but they loved us, so they gave us a lot of their staff time. And by phone, they would debug things that we couldn't debug by ourselves. They sort of like got their hearts into helping this cripple walk. So then after that, then we got into the, you know, like a serious act. 86 was when the great boycott sort of like, when the union decided, okay, we have this great boycott sitting out here, let's do it.
Uh-huh.
And that's when some people like Dave Martinez went out on the boycott. And then I moved from the financial management / computer project over to social marketing, which was the biggest department at La Paz and the one where we were, you know, doing a lot of our work. And that's when I was doing when I, and then in, right after the convention in October of 88, I took a leave of absence, which Caesar and I had agreed to about a year before that I was going to do that. So I went for 6 weeks.
What,
to the 1st of January 1989.
What was that day? You talked about the, you know, how the National Farm Worker Ministry basically, I don't want to say burnout, but getting tired. What, you know, there's another several years here that you went through a progression of functions, activities.
What happened now? There's another transition in your life, right?
Which one?
Well, when you're saying that you...
Oh, from leaving the union, you mean?
Leaving the union, right, yeah.
Well, that was not voluntary.
Sometimes we are transitioned, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you...
That's a...
Care to discuss? I mean, I don't want to... Yeah.
I don't know what to say about that for tape. Well, I can say that it was one of the hardest things that ever happened to me in my life, and it took me several years to get over. And I came to Sacramento to work with the homeless, feeling very homeless myself.
I want to say that there's been a visible change in your demeanor as we start looking at this. It still has its impact on you.
Yeah. Well, to make a long story short, while I was doing this computer project and also managing financial management, our chief accountant, who I hired and trusted and was responsible for, stole a lot of money. Not from the union, but from the National Farm Worker Service Center, one of the entities. And that happened in like 85, 86. And we didn't discover it until around Christmas time, 1988, when I was on my leave of absence. And for whatever reason, Caesar decided that the union needed a scapegoat, and I was it.
So the buck stopped with you,
I believe deeply that if he had come to me and said, Chris, this could become public, you know, and other unions are going to wonder if they should give us money, and it could hurt the union. Yeah. And Bryce Spacey, you know, we can prosecute him, we can put him in jail, but he wasn't really responsible. Yeah. It was like one of us was responsible. You were responsible.
It happened on your watch. So.
It happened during my watch, so what I need is for you to, like, resign. I can't believe I would have said no.
Yeah.
It would have hurt me a lot, but I think... But instead of doing that, Caesar needed to be, because of who he was, he needed to be sure of the outcome. Mm-hmm. I mean, if he had done that, if he had laid that out to me, he wouldn't have known how I would react, the hell with you, this is crazy.
Fight.
Okay. So basically what he did was he organized the board into a star chamber indictment. And the board as a unit charged me with being unfaithful. Not following Caesar's orders. Caesar didn't like this guy. I should have listened to Caesar. I should have gotten rid of him. Maybe I was somehow involved. Mm-hmm. Like, could he have done this by himself? Yeah. And if he didn't do it by himself, is it possible, you know, that I, you know...
It just couldn't reside as a problem down here at this level that somebody had done something and you deal with it. They couldn't.
So it became like this. All of a sudden I was in the company of enemies who were organized, pre-organized, to force me to realize that I had to leave. And Caesar was just like a block of ice. Like, you know, he didn't know me. And I was pretty much in shock. I didn't defend myself well. I mean, I thought of many things I should have said that I never said.
It was like a tremendous blow.
Yeah, I mean, I was just... So basically, I went on a leave of absence and then began to think about what was going on and talked to people like Leroy and realized that I wasn't going to be... Yeah. That I couldn't work with Caesar anymore, which means I had to leave. I had no choice. Mm-hmm. And in the interim, he had somehow persuaded himself that I was the enemy. So we left on... horrible, horrible terms. And I never talked to him again.
Bill Chandler has, in his interview we did, and many discussions, you know, we had the opportunity to spend about 3 days, you know, when we were working down there with the events and in between the events and sharing, you know, meals and talking. He remains committed and supportive as you of the movement of, you know, the struggle for justice. But he talks about, what is it, the Synanon game as a tactic. And you might know he talked about it like a star chamber, but he, you know, he said one of the reasons he went to Texas is he wanted to keep working on the cause, but be as far away from that hub as possible, because he says there were just things there that he couldn't, that didn't fit with the struggle for justice.
Well, I've always been able to rationalize Caesar's decision that somebody had to, you know, take the responsibility, and that somebody probably had to leave. I can never accept the way he did it. And so I was, I mean, it's I didn't realize, I had no idea how much my identity was tied up in La Causa, and how much my place in the world and in the human community was tied up in my work with the farm workers, because 27 years. I had never had to think about it. But then all of a sudden I'm in Sacramento and I'm feeling like a guy at age, what,
it's very interesting,
57, starting his life all over again.
And Leroy was already here.
Leroy was here. Thank God. I don't know what I would have done.
Yeah.
Leroy just said, think about it. Come to Sacramento. He says, I don't even have a full-time job for you, but come up here and try it out. If you like it, you know, stay for a long time. If you don't like it, don't stay for a long time. But after 27 years, you don't know what the hell you want to do with your life. So
we build our identities on a day-to-day basis as we go through our lives.
Yeah. Anyway, it was a very, very excruciatingly difficult period for me. But Saturday night was like, a few years ago, I enjoyed Saturday night. Mm-hmm. Ari Rodriguez was part of this star chamber. He was like a block of ice too. All I could think was, Artie, I preached at your wedding. I mean, Father Tobin and I married you and Lou. I mean, you know, I didn't say anything. That's, in my mind, I was thinking, how can you participate in this? But Saturday, I felt fine. I mean, we were among friends. I was glad to see Artie.
It was good.
He alluded to the fact that I had preached at Lou's at their wedding, you know, in 1973 or 4 or whenever it was, 74. So, I mean, there's somebody should say they're sorry.
Yeah.
But nobody will. And I've kind of like accepted that. And just kind of like, life goes on.
Yeah. Julio Hernandez has a very interesting refrain when you talk with him. He says, if you spend your lifetime building a house and then you move out of the house, you don't tear it down. So you don't tear it down. And I think, to me, that is the incredibly centered response to a...
God I never felt a minute's bitterness about what we had all done together. I mean, I could have, but I didn't. I think some of my kids felt a little bitter, you know, about like all we went through all this, and then look at this. But I never. Yeah. I mean, I always know and know to this day that we did great things together, and that we wouldn't have done them without Caesar. We would not have built this movement without him. No way. But he was not a perfect person. He was definitely not a saint.
Yeah, well, Antonio Salavedo says, you know, one of the problems when people start looking back in retrospect, and sometimes even at the time, is, well, he didn't do this, he didn't do this. He says, you know, he wasn't God.
He wasn't going to come down and do things for you. What he did, he showed you how to do things and encouraged you to do them. He says, and that was that's very important. But he says, but she kept, saying, one time in the course of, I don't know, what, half hour, about four or five times, she says, you know, he wasn't God. He wasn't going to come and fix everything, just, you know.
Well, there's no doubt that, he and I had a perfect working relationship from 1961 to 1981. Mm-hmm. And when I got to La Paz, I was right there. I was his department head. I was working for him instead of beside him, right? Mm-hmm. And we clashed more often than we had before. We didn't clash very much, but, I mean, I had known him a long time, so I could argue with him in a way that some people wouldn't.
This is clashes on,
policy stuff. Yeah,
strategy, policy.
Yeah. Yeah, and if it was my department, I could rarely change his mind, but I could argue him to a standstill. Mm-hmm. And I was proud of those arguments because nothing seemed to change. Caesar never... I mean, if half an hour later, it was like nothing had ever happened. We would be shouting at each other. And by the afternoon, it was like nothing had happened. I always felt. But when this other thing happened, then he began to reflect back and began to put two and two together that I had become, you know, a disloyal person. Someone out of control. That would not have occurred if it hadn't, if Rice Spacey, who had worked for me, hadn't stole that money. That was like the occasion for Caesar to start thinking about, like, what you know, how did that happen?
Is this, you know, this kind of a process of, you know, the isolation and then the, what was it, like a inquisition thing, is that something that came out of a later phase, or was it something in the organization all along? Or
I don't know.
I mean, that's kind of puzzling because
I don't know.
There's a lot of talk today, and there's a lot of literature. People make their careers about reinventing, restructuring, reorganizing, whatever. Mm-hmm.
I don't think it had anything to do with that. I think it had to do with the fact that... Remember, this was right after the fast of 88. Okay? And Caesar had broken his wrists up in La Paz trying to do some painting, and he wasn't recovering quickly. But even more importantly, the growers were not calling. It's like, after that fast of 88, what are we going to do in 89? Mm-hmm. If they aren't going to initiate some negotiation now... What can we do in 89 that would be more than we've done that would get them to call? So I'm sure he was feeling, he was not entirely well physically, he was feeling the pressure of the apparent failure of the fast and all the support that came from the fast to get the growers to negotiate or at least talk or express some interest in talking. So he was under a lot of pressure, and it was in that context that he began to sort of like believe there were people working in the boycott who were working against us, you know, it's like enemies within. And
there's an explanation of why things weren't moving forward.
Maybe. But maybe just as a response to stress. I mean, but it was in that context that he found out about, you know, that Bryce had stolen this money from us and that it was, you know, my department where he had worked. Mm-hmm. So I think he just did what he usually does during the holidays or whenever. He just took a walk around La Paz and thought about it and thought about it and thought about it. And he decided, this is my guess, right? I'm just guessing. Chris has to go. I mean, that's the only solution. I mean, otherwise the union's going to take a hit or my reputation's going to take a hit. Chris has to go. Having decided that, He then, because of who he is, his nature, he had to control the outcome. The outcome had to be organized. He couldn't just sit down with me and say, Chris, you need to resign because this and this and this, because he, as I said earlier, he wasn't sure how I would respond to that. I wasn't just like the average staff person, you know. I'd been around a long, long time. I'd been on campaigns with many people. I'd married their kids, and anyway, you know. So it wasn't like the average firing. So he wanted to be sure of the outcome, and he wanted the others to participate so that no one would be grousing at him for the way he had handled Chris's problem, right? So he basically organized the board in such a way that the outcome would be certain and that they would have blood on their hands also. And that's what he did. And it left me basically with no one to talk to and with no alternative but to leave. And it took me a little while to figure out what had actually happened. But that's, you know... So I just think it was indigenous to his need to control. But it also came at a time of high stress for him.
And probably over the fast and the breaking of the arm and so forth, probably maybe even physical...
Yeah,
strength is down.
He was not himself. After the fast of 88, he was not himself for a while. And there might have been a period like that in the 70s when Caesar kind of like, maybe after Prop 14, Caesar wasn't quite himself. I wasn't at La Paz, so I don't know about it as well. But then all those other years when we were at La Paz, it was just like the same old guy we always know. And the only reason I ever had any arguments with him was because I was now his department. I mean, you know, I now work for him. Until this crisis hit. But it was very...
When you mentioned of restructuring, one of the things that someone has mentioned to us along the way is that there was a basic structural problem in the union that sort of cut off avenues of communication, and that's the fact that the union was set up with field offices rather than locals. So you didn't have voting membership.
I think in the corporate world today we'd be talking about a lack of bottom-up communication, you know, that it was all top-down communication. And probably a lot of people in field offices who didn't, you know, college students or people that had come out of college in the cities and didn't know farm workers. And what's your reaction to that?
I have a theory. I mean, I don't know. If Caesar had a flaw, you know, a significant flaw, it was his need to control, his need to be involved in even tiny details, how the child care center runs at La Paz, you know, whether or not we move the dump from one place to another place. Anyway, Caesar needed to be involved in most decisions, and it was hard for him to let go of things. And when he did let go of things, it was hard for him to trust what was happening out there, whether it was the legal department in Salinas or the organizing effort in Texas or the contract administration effort in Florida. If it was out there somewhere and not reporting regularly, it's just like he couldn't help it. He had a hard time trusting what was going on out there. So I think that was and of course the field office idea is you have your own staff running field office. You don't have independent locals that elect their leadership and make decisions that are different from the decisions of the National Executive Board. That's just, you know, you don't have that. And there's some advantages to that too.
Very different from what people say about Caesar when in the early years, about what a tremendous listener he was. And you said that, Leroy said it. You know, and how he used that to make the organization work.
And what a great organizer he was, and how he could get people involved. But I think the problem was always there. Mm-hmm. It's just that as the organization grew, I mean, as there was success, and we had an institution, and the direction of the institution mattered to the parent, I think his need to control like became more visible and more detrimental.
Leroy said something very interesting today. I suppose some psychohistorian could have make some sense of it sometime. But he said that on at least a couple of occasions, he and Caesar spoke to him about wanting to leave. That he always saw himself as an organizer,
right,
rather than an administrator. And maybe he knew his own weakness in that area.
Not only that, but he believed deeply in democracy. And I mean, and it's not that, I'm not arguing with like the way he viewed the world or thought about the world or thought about the union or thought about democracy. I'm talking about what he could actually, you know, psychologically and emotionally do. And he had a real hard time letting things get too far away from him. And when he did, he had a really hard time trusting what was going on out there. And it affected his relationship to people. I mean, a trusted lieutenant sent to Florida was all of a sudden someone maybe to be watched more closely.
There's certainly a number of people who gave many years of their lives to the Union who have left on less than wonderful terms and have a lot of resentment.
But anyway, it's like it's this great man, this really great man with this like crack. Mm-hmm. And under stress, the crack widened. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened to me. Mm-hmm. And some others. I got 5 minutes. This time, anyway.
Okay.
And when you send me this transcript, I don't know whether I'm going to leave this stuff in or not.
Well, that's certainly up to you.
Would you talk a little bit about the number of women that you knew in the union and maybe who some of them were and what roles they fulfilled, etc.?
That sheet, didn't it?
I mean, we know Dolores was there.
Course,
although,
course.
You or Leroy have really not mentioned Dolores much. Her role always seemed a bit vague to me. I mean, most of the books say
Dolores.
You mention her as one of the union leaders. You
know, yeah, and founders.
Yeah, certainly.
I mean,
we know
there was only one founder.
What happened?
There was only one founder.
Right.
But Dolores came.
20 years.
Dolores and Gil came as early as anyone after that, right?
Uh-huh.
After the founding, they came pretty early in this in the movement. Well, Dolores is just anyway, she's another story all by herself. But she was certainly there, and there isn't, you know, a braver, more committed, you know, labor leader anywhere that I know of. Nothing. Dolores is afraid of nothing, and put herself many times in very, very tough, dangerous, sticky spots, and she is as remarkably gifted speaker. She's one of the few persons I know who can attune herself to an audience and say exactly the right thing to that audience, even though she doesn't know them. She instinctively kind of like knows who they are and what they should hear. She does a great job of it.
And there were a lot of other women working in the 40 acres and then the pause.
Yeah. And strikers and strike leaders, right.
Mm-hmm.
And nuns came along, quite a few of them.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of, like, significant leaders?
Well, significant in the players, if you will. Leader, sometimes we think of sometimes, but people who are...
Sister Mary Jean, you know, Friel. She was Sister Mary Jean Friel. She left the order and married Leo Nieto, so was really... And then some of the folks who worked directly with Caesar, you know, Esther Winterroad and... names. I can see her face, but I'm not going to remember her name.
Yeah.
Well, and the key people in the medical plan too. I think Maria Saldana was a key person in the medical plan. Did you meet her husband through the RFK medical plan? Anyway, Ann McGregor, Sister Mary Ethel Lopez, Sister Florence Weber was very important. She's now dead. I'm trying to think of some of the other nuns who came and worked side by side. Ruth Shy. But anyway, I was more struck by the women who were strike leaders, uh-huh. and most of whose names I never really knew, because I never worked side by side with them. I would come to the picket line and see what they were doing, and meet them at strike meetings, and they might recognize me because I got to speak as a representative of the churches or whatever, right? But I was always amazed at how strong they were, and how much stronger many of them were than the men. The men were often like qualified, it's not the right word, but anyway, they were limited a little bit by the struggles they were having at home. Right? I mean, just think about it. So who is this Cedar Chavez? I mean, is he going to feed our kids? Is he going to put shoes on their feet when they go to school in the fall? I mean, like, you know, so you're going to go on strike, rah, rah, rah. You can lose your job. That's what always happens. Then what are we going to do? And you know, but he'll get you all excited, and then he'll go somewhere else and
take your dues.
And take your dues, and what do we have to show for it? I mean, every family must have had that. And when you think about the history of what hadn't worked, right? It's just it's a miracle that so many people trusted and followed and took the risks that they took. God.
That's another area I'd like to pursue with you in the future, because I think Leroy's phrased it in terms of the billions of dollars that were spent to defeat the Union.
Yeah, the forces arrayed against the Union.
And how you continue in the face of those forces. I mean, you know, the picketer has the immediate pressure on himself and his family and feeding his kids and whatnot.
But all up and down the line, everybody was sheriff's department, I mean, the state,
you name it,
courts,
the governor, Ronald Reagan, Jesus. Well, you talk about, sort of like an example of the power of love against the forces of fear and hate. And that there was just kind of like love permeated the whole. The farm workers just, they loved Caesar. Not because he was cute or charismatic, but because he had helped them stand up in a way that they had always yearned to do and had never had the courage to do before. And so like they felt so good about that, and then they loved him for it. And all these church people and all these boycotters, basically the farm workers, Caesar and the farm workers kind of like reached for the very best in all of us and gave us an avenue for, you know, like working for justice, for doing what our hearts want us to do, and gave it meaning and sense and organization and structure and success. So all over the country, people are just, they wouldn't articulate it that way, but they were just like, they liked themselves so much better for being involved, and then they loved Dr. La Causa for getting them involved. And when the boycott ended, people felt horrible. They felt betrayed, they felt bitter, they felt lonely. Like, what am I going to do with my life? Because it was so meaningful for them. And so the growers were up against something they did not understand. Of course, the Teamsters, for sure. But the Teamsters are like a, Caesar said in the early days of the Coachella strike, well, Chris, he says, when the Catholic bishops came in, right, because of the Teamster involvement in 73, the bishops had sort of like standoffish and helping with mediation, but no direct support. But the bishops came in to support the boycott after. He says, well, the Gurus can have the Teamsters. I'll take the church. And he was right. Yeah. I got to go. I really got to go. Yeah.